it's very interesting that there have been a lot of musicals, and the ones that have done well, and quite a few that have won the Oscar, like The Sound of Music, like West Side Story, like Oliver, in fact, those were all sort of before a certain period. In contemporary times, the only musical that's won the Best Picture Oscar was Chicago. And for a long time, musicals on screen went fallow. And the thinking was because musicals essentially are non-realistic by their very definition. I mean, in speech, you and I, Ben, aren't singing to each other, although perhaps we could. But and film being a literal medium, it looked strange if all of a sudden, you know, in a contemporary musical or a contemporary movie, Tom Hanks stops talking and starts singing. But in plays, we accept that. What was interesting about Chicago on screen, very, very cleverly directed by Rob Marshall, was that the musical sequences essentially were contained within their own world. So it wasn't like Renee Zellweger and Catherine Zeta-Jones are having a chat, and all of a sudden they start to sing at each other. It made sense.
The voice of Matt Wolf, theatre critic for The New York Times. He'll join me for this special musically-themed edition of The Cinema Show, and we might even challenge him to a quiz, too. Also ahead today...
Princess Ozma was all unaware that the army of Ugaboo, led by their ambitious queen, was determined to conquer her kingdom. The beautiful girl ruler of Oz was busy with the welfare of her subjects and had no time to think of Anne Soforth and her disloyal plans.
Long before Judy Garland ventured over the rainbow, The Land of Oz took to the stage in the form of a musical play written by L. Frank Baum. Plus, remember when Frank Sinatra was stranded in Australia?
Mr. Sinatra did not intend any general reflection on the moral character of the working members of the Australian media.
That's it? That's all there is? Where's the part where he says he's sorry?
And later in the show, we'll pay tribute to everyone's favourite chocolatier, Gene Wilder. That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of movies, right here on Monocle 24. How do you prefer your musicals? Filled with spontaneous and mostly unexplained bursts of song? Or rather more sensibly structured, with musical numbers relegated to dream sequences like 2002's Chicago? Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. We're devoting much of this week's program to the movie musical and, of course, its origins on the stage too. L. Frank Baum's classic book, The Wizard of Oz, was first published in 1900, and by 1902 it had already made its musical debut on the stage. MGM's 1939 production, starring Judy Garland, is one of the greatest musicals of all time, and probably one of those very few films that everyone has seen. By the time it premiered, Baum's original series of books spanned 14 titles, including TikTok of Oz, a story that he based upon his own original musical play. Here's Monocle's Paul Osborne reading an extract from L. Frank Baum's book, published in 1914, The TikTok Man of Oz.
We must be over the rainbow.
Chapter 3. Magic Mystifies the Marchers. Princess Ozma was all unaware that the army of Ugaboo, led by their ambitious queen, was determined to conquer her kingdom. The beautiful girl ruler of Oz was busy with the welfare of her subjects and had no time to think of Anne Soforth and her disloyal plans. But there was one who constantly guarded the peace and happiness of the Land of Oz, and this was the official sorceress of the kingdom, Glinda the Good.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who, me? I'm not a witch at all. I'm Dorothy Gale from Kansas.
In her magnificent castle, which stands far north of the Emerald City where Ozma holds her court, Glinda owns a wonderful magic record book in which is printed every event that takes place anywhere just as soon as it happens. The smallest things and the biggest things are all recorded in this book. If a child stamps its foot in anger, Glinda reads about it. If a city burns down, Glinda finds the fact noted in her book. The sorceress always reads her record book every day, and so it was she knew that Anne Soforth, Queen of Oogaboo, had foolishly assembled an army of 16 officers and one private soldier with which she intended to invade and conquer the Land of Oz.
I want to go home!
I am Oz, the great and powerful. Who are you? Who are you?
If you please, I am Dorothy, the small and meek.
There was no danger but that Ozma, supported by the magic arts of Glinda the Good and the powerful Wizard of Oz, both her firm friends could easily defeat a far more imposing army than Anne's. But it would be a shame to have the peace of Oz interrupted by any sort of quarrelling or fighting. So Glinda did not even mention the matter to Ozma, or to anyone else. She merely went into a great chamber of her castle, known as the Magic Room, where she performed a magical ceremony which caused the mountain pass that led from Oogaboo to make several turns and twists. The result was that when Anne and her army came to the end of the pass, they were not in the Land of Oz at all, but in an adjoining territory that was quite distinct from Ozma's domain and separated from Oz by an invisible barrier. As the Oogaboo people emerged into this country, the pass they had traversed disappeared behind them, and it was not likely they would ever find their way back into the Valley of Oogaboo. They were greatly puzzled, indeed, by their surroundings and did not know which way to go. None of them had ever visited Oz, so it took them some time to discover they were not in Oz at all, but in an unknown country. "Never mind," said Anne, trying to conceal her disappointment. "We have started out to conquer the world, and here is part of it. In time, as we pursue our victorious journey, we will doubtless come to Oz. But until we get there, we may as well conquer whatever land we find ourselves in." "Have we conquered this place, Your Majesty?" anxiously inquired Major Cake. "Most certainly," said Anne. "We have met no people as yet, but when we do, we will inform them that they are our slaves. And afterward, we will plunder them of all their possessions," added General Apple. "They may not possess anything," objected Private Files, "but I hope they will fight us just the same. A peaceful conquest wouldn't be any fun at all." "Don't worry," said the Queen, "we can fight, whether our foes do or not, and perhaps we would find it more comfortable to have the enemy surrender promptly." It was a barren country and not very pleasant to travel in. Moreover, there was little for them to eat, and as the officers became hungry, they became fretful. Many would have deserted had they been able to find their way home, but as the Oogaboo people were now hopelessly lost in a strange country, they considered it more safe to keep together than to separate. Queen Anne's temper, never very agreeable, became sharp and irritable as she and her army trampled over the rocky roads without encountering either people or plunder. She scolded her officers until they became surly, and a few of them were disloyal enough to ask her to hold her tongue. Others began to reproach her for leading them into difficulties, and in the space of 3 unhappy days, every man was mourning for his orchard in the pretty valley of Oogaboo. Files, however, proved a different sort. The more difficulties he encountered, the more cheerful he became, and the sighs of the officers were answered by the merry whistle of the private. His pleasant disposition did much to encourage Queen Anne, and before long she consulted the private soldier more often than she did his superiors. It was on the 3rd day of their pilgrimage that they encountered their first adventure. Toward evening, the sky was suddenly darkened, and Major Nails exclaimed, "A fog is coming towards us." "I do not think it is a fog," replied Files, looking with interest at the approaching cloud. "It seems to me more like the breath of a rack." "What is a rack?" asked Anne, looking about fearfully. "A terrible beast with a horrible appetite," answered the soldier, growing a little paler than usual. I have never seen a rack, to be sure, but I have read of them in the storybooks that grew in my orchard. And if this is indeed one of those fearful monsters, we are not likely to conquer the world. Hearing this, the officers became quite worried and gathered closer about their soldier. "What is this thing like?" asked one. "The only picture of a rack that I ever saw in a book was rather blurred," said Files, "because the book was not quite ripe when it was picked. But the creature can fly in the air and run like a deer and swim like a fish. Inside its body is a glowing furnace of fire, and the rack breathes in air and breathes out smoke, which darkens the sky for miles around wherever it goes. It is bigger than 100 men and feeds on any living thing." The officers now began to groan and to tremble, but Files tried to cheer them, saying, "It may not be a rack after all that we see approaching us, and you must not forget that we people of Oogaboo, which is part of the fairyland of Oz, cannot be killed." "Nevertheless," said Captain Buttons, "if the rack catches us and chews us up into small pieces and swallows us, what will happen then?" "Then each small piece will still be alive," declared Files. "I cannot see how that would help us," wailed Colonel Banjo. "A hamburger steak is a hamburger steak, whether it is alive or not."
Monocle's Paul Osborne reading an extract from The TikTok Man of Oz, first published in 1914 and part of L. Frank Baum's original series of books, many of which are today out of print. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, where this week we're all about musicals at the movies. But of course, where would the musical screen be without the stage? Matt Wolfe is the theatre critic for The New York Times, and he joins me now in the studio. Matt, first, I want you to take me back to some of your earliest memories of just being wowed by musicals on the stage.
One of the first I remember seeing was, I must have been 10 or 11, a Broadway revival of On the Town, which is a wonderful Leonard Bernstein musical, immortal book by Comden and Green, wonderful team, Betty Comden and Adolph Green. And there have been lots and lots of Broadway revivals of it. So this was one of many different Broadway revivals, and it had the sublime Bernadette Peters in it. And I remember her, and I remember her hair. She's always had very distinctive hair. Just how fun it was and how celebratory of New York. And as, you know, growing up in New York, seeing the show in New York, it was kind of wonderful that the musical completed the package in terms of this kind of fantasia of New York. It was great.
Okay, Matt, it's the moment you've been waiting for, where you finally get to test your teeth as a critique of the stage. First question for you. The musical Guys and Dolls is based upon two stories by which author?
Damon Runyon.
Now, it was also nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1951, but it did not win. Why?
Why didn't it win?
Why did it not win?
I have no idea.
There was something going on in the 1950s in America that prevented it from winning the Pulitzer Prize. What was that?
There was?
Because the writer Abe Burrows, he had troubles with the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Is that the reason?
That's the reason. And the trustees for Columbia University, they actually vetoed that selection, and there was no Pulitzer Prize awarded for drama that year.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So you've got one right, one wrong.
Thanks, Ben.
Five songs from the stage production were actually omitted from the film version. Name one of them.
Oh, probably More I Cannot Wish You.
That is definitely one of them, yes. The others we were looking for could have been A Bushel and a Peck, My Time of Day, I've Never Been in Love Before, or Marry the Man Today.
Can I just put in a little on-air bid for More I Cannot Wish You as the great neglected masterpiece from that score, because it's not sung by one of the four principals. It's sung by an older character who, if you see the show, you'll see who he is. And it's just the most beautiful song about wishing love on a young person.
Well, anyone tuning into that film should definitely go and look that up as a little addendum. Songs that were added to the movie, though, include Pet My Popper, A Woman in Love, and Adelaide. And now, Matt, finally, your question for today. Complete this lyric. They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt.
Because time has a very uneasy way of running out?
Yes, at times you have a very unladylike way of running out, but close enough.
Well, close, but not much of a cigar.
Well, that concludes our musical quiz time for this week. Thanks to my quizzical guest, Matt Wolf, theatre critic for The New York Times. Up next, we'll take a flight to Australia with Frank Sinatra. Stay with us.
Whether you're a guy or a doll, movies got you covered this weekend with a triple bill of movie musicals.
This is all I need. It's complete.
Catch Frank Sinatra and Marlon Brando in Guys and Dolls, Jodie Foster in Bugsy Malone, and of course, Catherine Zeta-Jones and Renée Zellweger in Chicago.
I bet you want to know why I shot the bastard.
Shut up, dummy.
And if you haven't tried MUBI, now's the perfect time. You can get it for a song with a whole month free. Head to MUBI.com/Monaco. That's MUBI/Monaco.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. We're all about the movie musical this week, but right now, I want to take you back to a time when some throwaway comments by Frank Sinatra had Australians smashing his records, blocking his jet from taking off, and even cutting off his room service. Monocle's contributor in Melbourne, Glenn Dunks, recalls the bizarre siege of Sinatra.
There's no one in the place except you and me.
In 1974, one of the strangest moments of Frank Sinatra's career unfolded while on tour in Melbourne, Australia, when he became embroiled in a scandal that was labelled the Siege of Sinatra, and would find Old Blue Eyes, one of the most famous entertainers the world has ever known, trapped in a hotel with no way out. It was a bizarre moment in time, memorialised in Paul Goldman's 2003 film, The Night We Called It a Day, that starred Dennis Hopper as Sinatra, although his singing voice was dubbed by local stage and screen star Tom Berlinson, and Melanie Griffith as his soon-to-be wife, Barbara Marx.
And one more for the road.
Sinatra, Marx, and his entourage arrived in Australia on the 9th of July and were instantly hounded by the press and paparazzi. But while on stage that night, performing a set list of 12 songs, nobody could have prepared the Australian media for the over-the-top antics that happened next.
Mr. Sinatra, I think you owe me an apology. I'm waiting, Mr. Sinatra. I'm waiting for you to say you're sorry.
The Night We Called It a Day, titled after a song recorded by Sinatra, and which eventuated nearly 30 years after the events, has a light-hearted tone that is consistent with the irreverent story that is more well-known today as a slice of Sinatra and Australian political trivia. It gets great mileage out of the retro costumes, sets, and comical, oversized wigs. However, considering how fascinating the true story is, its cinematic concessions mean it never quite comes together. These include taking historical liberties with the story, such as the invention of lead characters, a concert promoter and his girlfriend, played by Joel Edgerton and Rose Byrne, as well as a gossip columnist played by Portia de Rossi, who the movie positions as the one particular focus of Sinatra's scorn.
The night we called it a day.
I got an apology to make to Hillary Hunter. I called this young woman a $2 whore. I was wrong. I apologize for that. I overpaid. She's not worth a buck and a half. This broad is so ugly that her mother had to tie a pork chop around her neck so that the dog would play with her.
That night on stage in Melbourne, in between songs, Sinatra went into what he thought was a funny routine, wherein he labelled the local journalists as bums, the paparazzi as parasites and pimps, and most famously, that women in the media are hookers, not even worth a buck and a half. Coming so soon after the release of Germaine Greer's era-defining book The Female Eunuch, and Helen Reddy's iconic song I Am Woman, Sinatra's old-world attitudes were at odds with a changing society. The Australian Council of Trade Unions, headed by future Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke, voted unanimously for a ban on Sinatra's tour until he apologised to the press. Sinatra refused, resulting in a union strike across the board. That meant no airport workers to fill up the petrol on his jet and no hotel staff to cook and bring him food. Hawke was said to have suggested that the only way Sinatra would get out of the country without apologising was if he could walk on water.
Mr. Sinatra did not intend any general reflection on the moral character of the working members of the Australian media.
Mr. Hawke,
wait a minute. That's it? That's all there is? He walks?
You didn't hear what I said.
Where's the part where he says he's sorry?
What we have here, what Mr. Hawke has graciously put his name to.
2 days later, Sinatra and Hawke met in the $250 a night presidential suite of the Boulevard Hotel where Sinatra had been staying, and the two eventually reached a compromise. Sinatra released a statement saying he did not intend any general reflection upon the moral character of working members of the Australian media, and that he regretted the inconvenience caused to patrons who missed his subsequent concerts as a result of the incident. He then finished his tour in Sydney. But once back on home soil in Las Vegas, he mocked the incident. A funny thing happened in Australia. I made a mistake and got off the plane. For Monocle in Melbourne, I'm Glenn Dunks.
I'm going to tell you the truth, but you will not believe me.
Nathan, why can't we elope?
I have to go to a prayer meeting.
That is the biggest and most unforgivable lie you have ever told.
Author and film critic Glenn Dunks recalling the siege of Sinatra, as depicted in the Australian film The Night We Called It a Day. Glenn is also the author of Sinatra, 100 Years, from Wilkinson Publishing. And finally today, no list of definitive movie musicals would be complete without 1971's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like The Wizard of Oz decades before it, few childhoods have escaped its dark humour and cautionary wisdom. Of course, it's a particularly poignant bookend to our show this week, with the sad passing of the film's legendary star, Gene Wilder. Here's Monocle's Andrew Muller.
When it was decided to make a film of Roald Dahl's 1964 children's fable Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, it would have been very easy to get it wrong, and indeed, some decades later, Tim Burton did. There would have been every temptation to write and cast the reclusive confectionery mogul Willy Wonka as a cheerful, avuncular, family-friendly character, a cross between Santa Claus and P.T. Barnum. But Dahl, who co-wrote the screenplay, and Mel Stewart, who directed, had other ideas. Their Willy Wonka, while clearly big-hearted and whimsical, should also be, when provoked by the spoilt, unruly brats who'd won the golden ticket tour of his factory, irritable, sarcastic, and vindictive. The role of Wonka therefore called for a cuddly comic presence with a startlingly flint-hearted core, a large and sincere smile, secreting surprisingly sharp fangs. It called for Gene Wilder.
Look what it's done to my kid!
It always goes wrong when we come to the dessert. Always.
Violet, what are you doing now? You're blowing up!
I feel funny!
I'm not surprised.
What's happening?
You're blowing up like a balloon!
Like a blueberry.
Somebody do something! Call a doctor!
Stick her with a pin!
She'll pop!
It happens every time. They all become blueberries. You really
gotta... Wilder was born Jerome Silberman on June 11, 1933, to a Russian Jewish family in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The name he made famous was a homage to Thomas Wolfe's character Eugene Gant and the playwright Thornton Wilder. The transformation was achieved via study at the University of Iowa and at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre in the UK, where he also displayed some dash as a fencer, and a brief stint in the US Army, where he oversaw a psychiatric ward. He admitted that the experience taught him much he later drew upon. Gene Wilder learned his craft properly as a theatre player, by no means always a comic. He often reminded interviewers that, "I'm an actor, not a clown." He was made a star by the role of Leopold Bloom in Mel Brooks' 1968 comedy The Producers, about a pair of theatre impresarios who stage an inadvertently successful musical about Adolf Hitler. The Producers was a hit, which won Wilder an Oscar nomination, but his position in the firmament was not quite yet secure. Even Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, as the film was eventually called, took some years to acquire its now undisputed place in the pantheon. Wilder's name was properly made in the early 1970s by two roles. One, the ovinely inclined Dr. Ross in Woody Allen's Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, required him to overplay his animating neuroses. The other, desiccated gunslinger the Waco Kid in Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, required him to underplay them. Blazing Saddles is still routinely and quite rightly hailed as one of the funniest films ever made, due in no small part to Wilder's performance. Though his character is that of a relative straight man, the sane presence amid madness, Wilder doesn't play the kid as a naive stooge. He knows the joke is on him, but is nevertheless determined to be as amused by it as possible. If Wilder's best work was bought out of him by Mel Brooks, who also directed Wilder's pet project Young Frankenstein, his best-known work was done in collaboration with Richard Pryor, with whom Wilder combined to form a potent odd couple pairing, Wilder's anxious deadpan balancing Pryor's unbound mania through Silver Streak, Stir Crazy, See No Evil, Hear No Evil, and Another You. Wilder's productivity tapered in the 1980s and 1990s, a combination of professional disenchantment – he once said he enjoyed the show but not the business – and the illness and death of his third wife, the comedian Gilda Radner, from misdiagnosed ovarian cancer. Wilder established a detection centre in her name and lobbied Congress for additional funding to tackle the disease. He also sought to establish himself as a novelist. The books weren't bad, but it's fair to say they'd have attracted less attention if written by someone whose name wasn't Gene Wilder. Wilder died due to complications associated with Alzheimer's disease. A statement released by his family said that he kept the condition secret because he didn't want to distress generations of children who associated him with the twinkling chocolatier he'd depicted nearly half a century ago. He simply couldn't bear, they explained, the idea of one less smile in the world. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Muller.
Don't forget what happened to the man who suddenly got everything he always wanted.
What happened?
He lived happily ever after.
Well, that's it for today. If you are in London, be sure to catch a special screening of the rarely seen film noir classic, Too Late for Tears. It's just been restored by the Film Noir Foundation. We were featuring it a little while ago here on The Cinema Show. And I'll be hosting a special introduction at the Regent Street Cinema here in London. That's at 6:30 p.m. this Monday, the 5th of September. I hope to see you there. The Venice Film Festival has just kicked off, fittingly enough, opening with a musical, La La Land. We'll review some of the highlights on next week's show. Today's program was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Now grab yourself an everlasting gobstopper. We'll leave you now with the beautifully haunting sounds of Willy Wonka. Here's Gene Wilder performing Pure Imagination. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.